So we do have a speaker tonight, and it falls on me to introduce our speaker. I first met this individual in 2009, believe it or not. And those that know me well have heard me share about how I sort of found myself reaching out on cyberspace to find recovery. I was kind of a bit lost at one point in my own journey. And this individual was one of the people that was there. Well, I actually checked it out today. He joined a few days before I did. It's a forum that we were both a part of. We've kind of stayed in touch a little bit over the years. Just recently, we've reconnected. And it's been an absolute pleasure. And he very kindly agreed to come along and share his experience, strength, and hope with us this evening. It's late where he is. It's at 10:30, I believe, that we can start. Give some of them might know clearly where he is in the world. He just celebrated a fairly major milestone in recovery last month. And he's going to come on, he's come along tonight to share his experience, strength, and hope with us, his journey to, into, and through Narcotics Anonymous. And he's got 40, 45 minutes. Soro, welcome to the meeting, and the floor is yours, sir. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. That was very kind of you. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Surajit and I am an addict.
Hi, Surajit.
Welcome to the meeting.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor and a pleasure to be here. So let me tell you all the one thing that I know really well, which is Surajit's story. So, you know, I grew up in a middle-class family in India. It was, on the outside, the perfect family. My father was a doctor in the army. My mother was an educated lady. She was a housewife. I had an elder brother. And I was the younger son. The picture, if I really put it, you know, when you look at my family from outside, was like it was the ideal family. We in these lovely cantonments. I went to some of the best schools in India. But when I look back at my childhood, what I remember is a house that was filled with unsaid tension. The message that I always got growing up, and that what I remember is, you were not good enough, you know. So-and-so colonel's son has done better than you. Your brother has scored more marks than you. You should always be doing better. And I carried this baggage with me throughout my growing up. So when I passed out of this strict public school and I went to college, which was a far more liberal place, and I saw these bunch of people who were using, and I was like, look, I want to belong out here. Because all my life in my school, I always felt like this odd one out. You know, I always felt like the square peg in a round hole. Everyone seemed to be very comfortable doing what they were. I was the gangly one with the big nose, awkward around girls. I just never fitted in. I never fitted in. My father would, you know, get posted from one part of India to another. My schools would change, and wherever I went, I never fitted in. So in college, when I saw this interesting bunch of people who were using, I said, look, this seems to be my way of telling the world to go jump into a well. And I really want to belong out here. And the only way to belong was to use drugs. And I didn't want to become an addict. An addict was what you read in those days. There was a magazine called Reader's Digest, which had stories like, my son died in Kathmandu. Addicts were those people, you know. They were the ones who stuck needles in their arms, who went to the trash bins, who sold off stuff. I just wanted to belong. I wanted to use. I wanted to have a little party in college and then get a good job and fulfill the middle class dream. So that's how my using started. And what actually happened was 17 years of using, where in the last 5 years, I did everything that an addict could do in my head. And in the year 95, I walked into a rehab. And I didn't go to the rehab to stay clean. I went into the rehab because a month before that, I had gone to a institution where they had kept me locked up for 30 days. And there were a bunch of other addicts locked up in that same institution. It was a small place, a detox. And like any sensible addict would do when he's locked up with, you know, 5 or 10 other addicts, we just discussed, you know, where did you score your stash from and where did somebody else score their stash from. And I remember one of them telling me, look, if you want to go in for a long period of time, why don't you go to this rehab? And by then I had lost my job. I had been unemployed for 1.5 years. I was living off my mother. Father had died, so she used to get a pension, and I would live off her. My relatives didn't want to have anything to do with me. I remember I had a girlfriend. She walked out on me. My brother didn't want to have anything to do with me. So my life was essentially me and my mother, who couldn't walk away from me because of her beliefs or compulsions or whatever, or love, and me living off her. So when I came out of this detox and I got back to using, I sort of went to my mom and said, can I get admitted here? And somehow I managed to persuade her, and I went into this institute. And this is where I first heard about this program, the 12 steps. And I remember going to an inmates meeting, and I said, look, you know, y'all are making perfect sense. This is the first time I've heard anyone talk of my language. You know, y'all are really talking about my life. It's just that I'll just go out once and use, and then I will do exactly what you say. Because I really didn't want to stop using. 17 years, that's all I had done. Good days I had used, on bad days I had used, on just normal, boring days I had used it. I just wanted to figure out how to use safely. What combination of drugs could I use and carry on with life? It took me 3 or 4 months in that institution to actually figure out that, you know, I can't use drugs safely. And my immediate reaction was fear, because, you know, the fear was that I will go out and I will start using again. And by this time, my mind had cleared up and I could see the devastation of life. But to cut a long story short, I actually stayed there for 15 months. I didn't want to go out. After a few months, they said, please go home. I said, no, can I work with you? Because I was terrified of going out. And then finally, after about 14, 15 months, I said, no, look, I need to go out and I need to catch up with life. So I came out to a life which was very, very difficult. I came out to a mother who was very angry. She had suffered for 17 years of my using. I was 33 years old. I had no job. I had no self-confidence, no ways of getting a job. You know, I just felt full of guilt, full of shame, worthless, useless. And I started applying for jobs. Nothing worked out. And then I remember there was this book fair in this town, Calcutta, where I was. It was a huge event. It was an annual book fair, and I got a small job standing behind the counter and selling books. And I said, look, at least it'll give me some money. And for the first and last time in the history of the book fair, that bloody fair burnt down after 3 days. And I remember going to the meeting that evening and saying, fuck, man, if there's a higher power, that guy's a lunatic. You know, by then, and I'm really grateful to this institution, by then every evening I used to go to a meeting, because one thing had stuck in my head. In this institution, I had learned a lot of jargon. I had learned a lot about addiction. I used to give lectures on, you know, to inmates. When I came out, all of that, you know, sort of disappeared. But the one thing for which I'm forever grateful to that institution remained, which was like, you know, Shurajit, if you want to stay clean, go to an NA meeting. So right after I came out, I used to, every evening I would head to an NA meeting. And there were a bunch of us, you know, 3-4 of us. We were all struggling, early recovery. We had no money. We had no jobs. We were facing rough times at home. We would gather at the chai shop and we would laugh with each other at our troubles, you know. So slowly laughter and a few friends entered my life. But life still sucked. You know, early recovery, sometimes I've come to these meetings and I've heard about pink clouds. I didn't have any pink clouds. I had very dark clouds. There was no money. I had an angry mother. I would go asking her for money for cigarettes. I'd get a 2-hour lecture on how useless and how worthless you are. And, you know, I would keep applying for jobs and nothing worked out. But every evening I would go to a meeting, I'd look forward to it, and I would sit in that meeting and I would just feel a little bit of reassurance that, you know what, let me survive another day. And then I started working in a small setup, me and a friend of mine had set up. And very slowly, you know, there was a semblance of normalcy that entered my life. I started getting paid a very small amount, but it was still some money. And I would look at people, you know, I would travel in buses, I would look at people walking with their girlfriends, and I would like, you know, I would feel that, you know, that bus has passed by, nothing's going to happen. And then I got a girlfriend. Going around, and slowly, you know, by then, second year passed, and I was 3 years clean. When I took this decision to shift cities and come to a larger city, which is the capital, New Delhi, of India, I'd met a friend of mine from my college, and he was doing very well. He actually bumped into me on the road. He recognized me. He said, look, why aren't you looking for a better job? He gave me an address of a senior of mine. And I took that address and another NA member's address, and I left Calcutta with a little bit of money and I came to New Delhi. I was 3 years clean. And it was as if my cassette had hit a rewind button and I was starting right from the beginning again. The day I came, that evening, I went to an NA meeting in Delhi. It was in a local language. I couldn't understand the language. It was a small meeting. Everyone knew everybody, and I felt like the fifth wheel. I was 3 years, 12 days clean, and there was this huge ball of fear in my stomach. That is this the end of the road? Are you just going to come here and use? Will you survive? And I did the only thing that I knew that would work. I just kept going to the meetings every day. And slowly I started building some, you know, linkages, got some friends within that fellowship. And I got used to the local language. I started joining those meetings. And another 6 months went by. I was staying with a friend, looking for a job. And every day I would look at this little stash of money that I had, and it was getting less and less, and I was like, fuck, did I have to go back with my tail between my legs? And I remember my then sponsor had told me, he'd said, go to Delhi and see. If nothing happens, you'll come back. Because for me, it was like, you know, how could I take this failure? If I go there, if I don't get a job, if I don't succeed, I have to come back, you know, how will I face the world? How will I face the fellowship? And my sponsor had told me, you know, he sort of settled it for me. He said, just go. Max, what will happen? You won't get a job, you'll come back, but you'll carry on in life. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I got myself a job. My girlfriend also had followed me to Delhi. She'd actually come for her career thing. So we picked up the threads again. And, you know, that itself was a funny story. I couldn't bring myself to commit to her. We were going around for a year and a half. In my head, I would like, yes, I'll get married. And then, no, I won't get married. And I have this commitment phobia. I was like, fuck, no, how can I get married? How can I tie myself up to one woman? I don't know what was in my head. You know, would I have a bevy of beauties lined up for me? Fuck no. So, but it was just that, how can I commit? And then one fine day, she told me, look, I'm leaving. And I remember that day, I went to a friend of mine who was a non-NA friend, and I said, his name was Milind, and I said, Milind, what do I do? He said, don't be an idiot, man. ask her to marry you, and I took the best decision in my life. I went back and I asked her to marry me, and we got married. And by then I'd got this small job, and the next 5 years were a train wreck. You know, life hit me like a freight train. I had a new job, I was getting used to working, I had got married, and I had a young daughter who entered my life. I didn't know how to be a husband, I didn't know how to be a father. And the next 5 years, there were issues at home. I remember fights with wife, you know, money was tight. But I did, if I look back, the most sensible thing I did was I just landed up at an NA meeting and there were 4 days a week. And every day I would be sitting in that meeting for those 4 days. I didn't share, I didn't have a sponsor for those 5 years. And I didn't share because by the time I finished the discussion inside my head of, you know, is it worth sharing? Should I share? What will people think? How will they react? And I would put up my hand and someone would say, oh, you know what? The meeting time is over. Why don't you share at the next meeting? But I survived those 5 years because of those meetings. Because I went there, I just, you know, however fucked up I felt, however full of disturbances, full of angst I felt, I just felt I belonged. I stuck in there. I remember my wife telling me that, look, let's go for marriage counseling. And I had that initial arrogance of the 12 steps. I said, no, you need counseling. And then a few years later, I went groveling back to her and said, let's go for counseling. And we did therapy. And I was by then stuck in a dead-end job. It was a small setup. I was getting to 40, had a wife and a child. And in my head, I was like, look, you know, the train of life has passed me by. There's going to be no career. If I can just hang around, manage a small job, and just live with whatever little crumbs life gives me, I have to be satisfied. I would come to the meetings, I'd see people talking of new jobs, people talking of, you know, new stuff happening, cars, and I would say, look, none of that's going to happen in my life. And then 5 years later, suddenly I got this break. I got this a really good job with a big firm in the industry that I was in. And I remember when I got the offer, my first instinctive reaction was fear. That, okay, they've offered me the job, they've liked me. If I join, they'll find out what a fraud I am. And I remember the first few months of that job, I would keep going to the meetings, putting up my hand, and I would go through fear that today they'll find out what sort of a fraud I am and that means. Around this time, I was also going through a very lonely patch life, you know, because there were problems at home, inability of mind to open up and share. You know, I had reached a very lonely place in recovery. And I also remember, for most of my time in recovery, you know, people would say, pray, you know, talk to God, and everyone seemed to have a hotline to God, and I had tried my best to do that. And it didn't seem to be working for me. So around this time, I had put up my hand and said, look, I just don't believe in God. I'm sick and tired of pretending that I believe in God. I don't. And that sort of pushed me into further loneliness because the, you know, 2.5 friends that I had built up in the fellowship decided to walk away. And a lot of people very helpfully came and told me, oh, you know what? If you don't believe in God and you're an atheist, you'll probably end up using me. So this was the phase that I was going through. But I think the best thing I did was stick on to meetings. And then I got this job and then I settled into this new job. I started going for marriage counseling with my wife, and suddenly life took a different turn. You know, my career picked up. I started doing really, really well, and I started earning money. And suddenly life started proving to me that I wasn't on the wrong track, that it's okay to be, you know, okay with your beliefs. If you don't believe in God, it's okay not to believe in God. And, you know, my counseling, the marriage counseling seemed to work out. Things at home started getting better, money, you know, started getting paid well. And suddenly life became a better place to live. And you know, as I keep saying, you know, life started proving to me that you're not as bad as you think you are. You're not heading for a relapse if you believe there is no God. It's okay. It's okay to believe what you believe. And I got new friends in the fellowship. And there was this, you know, the next few years were really, really nice. Except that I think 5 years later, I had a heart attack. And I remember waking up in the intensive care unit and wondering, why me? You know, I'm coming to meetings, I'm working hard, I'm doing everything, I'm working the steps to the best of my ability in my life. And it took me some time to figure out that, you know, you're in the ICU not because of the program or the steps, it's because you probably eat too many eggs and too much butter and no exercise. Because, you know, my instinctive reaction to that event was, why me? And I'm truly grateful to the fellowship, the Delhi Fellowship, because they actually came home, they actually did a couple of meetings inside my house. They helped me pass through that. It was a very, very tough phase. There was a lot of fear. I remember when I came back from the hospital, they told me to stay at home for 2 weeks, not step out. And I remember stepping out after 2 weeks. And it's a very frightening feeling to know that your heart might stop any moment. You know? And the fellowship helped me go through that phase. And by then I had got into this rhythm. However busy my job, you know, I was at work, I would make sure I would do, you know, at least 3 or 4 meetings a week, even if it meant just reaching there, touching the meeting for 10 minutes, sometimes just reaching for the prayer, sometimes doing the whole meeting, but I just kept doing it. So I think that also helped me keep my feet on the ground because, you know, I achieved a lot of success at work. But the meetings helped me keep my perspective and my sanity. And I think after the heart attack, it also, I don't know, in some ways made me aware of my, you know, how would I call it, that life can just come to an end at any time. So I started putting a lot of effort and relationships at home with my wife, with my daughter. So I would pull out time from work and prioritize my wife and my daughter. And that really helped me build my relationship with my daughter. And she's today the apple of my eye, you know. Because in her early childhood, I don't think I was a very good father. First 5, 6, 7 years of her life, I was a very volatile person. A, I was busy trying to catch up on my career. B, I was just busy trying to figure out what it is to be a father. I was very volatile. I was very prickly. You know, if I'd come home from work and I'd say, Junior, get me a glass of water, and she was watching Cartoon Network, and she'd say, no, Dad, I'd go into a sulk for 2 days. I think after the heart attack, I sort of started putting a lot of effort on that relationship. And life went into a very good patch. I was doing really well at work. Things were good at home. Things were good with my kid. And then in 2018, there was a restructure in my office. By then, you know, I'd saved up a little bit of money, whatever. So I came home and I told my wife, look, I don't think I can work anymore here. And my wife's always been very supportive of me. She said, no sweat. Why don't you walk away from the job if you want? We'll figure something out. So I walked away from my work. And the next year and a half were a very dark phase in my life. Because for me, work has been a big anchor in my self-worth, my self-esteem, you know, because right from childhood, I had this message drilled into me that you're useless. And for the first time in my life, I was successful, I had done things well. And suddenly, it's as if the rug got pulled out under my feet. There was fear, there was uncertainty, I didn't know where life was leading. And I did the only thing that I knew I could do. I went to meetings and put up my hand and said, I'm scared. And I survived. The next year and a half, I learned how to cook. I went to a lot of conventions. I went back to Calcutta. I would go back frequently and I'd hang around with, you know, some friends from early recovery who'd see me when I had nothing. And my wife was very, very supportive. Really, I'm very thankful to her. She said, no sweat, they just go. It was around this time that my mom, who had grown very frail and old, she used to live alone in Calcutta. I sort of decided to bring her to stay with me. So that was another complication because my mom and me have a very mixed relationship or had. You know, there was a lot of love, but there was a lot of anger and angst in childhood. But I also realized, and thanks to you all, and thanks to the fellowship, that I have to do what's right. My brother just wanted to put her in an old age home and say, like, let's wash her hands off her. She's a batty old lady. And I'm glad I did that. So the next year and a half were very difficult. I brought my mom to live with me. I didn't have a job. I was unsure of where I was going. I would go to the meetings and put up my hand. Say, I'm scared. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm just... And then 2020, you know, I got another job. It was in a completely different sector. And again, my first reaction was not gratitude, not joy that I've got this. And I got this really good job. But fear. You know what? I'm going to join this place. And now they're going to find out I'm a fraud because I don't know anything of this sector. They've interviewed me. They think I'm good, but now they'll find out I'm a fraud. Anyway. I did the same thing. I just went back to the meeting and I put my hand up. I said, look, I'm scared. I got this job. I'm going to this office. And then, you know, now it's been 2.5 years in that job. My mom was with me till last year when, you know, the pandemic hit us and passed away. But I was glad I was able to do the right thing. The last few years of her life, I was there with her and I made sure I looked after her and did whatever I was supposed to do as a son. And you know, today, I'm at a good place in life. And I also know that this is a transient place to be in, you know? Like the slogan says, you know? This too shall pass. I've seen it in my life, that you never know when the rug gets pulled out of your feet, when the next shitstorm comes. But today, it's been 27 years, last June 6th, and I still go to meetings. I still make, you know, at least 3 meetings. The meetings have opened up in Delhi now. There are face-to-face meetings. I like to go there. I like to sit down there. I do whatever little service I can. And I like to stay in the middle of the fellowship, you know, because for me today, the classroom and the fellowship is my higher power. You know, I've come to terms with that. That for me, this is my God. These are my higher power. You know? You all are my higher power. And today, there's this bedrock of faith that has come that Shuraji, if you keep coming back, if you sit in these meetings, if you stay in the middle of the fellowship, you won't have to use. And however shitty today is, tomorrow you can reboot, you can restart the game. And I've been through a lot of rough times in recovery. I've been through a hell of a lot of good times also. But I've come to this understanding that if I stay in the middle of the fellowship, if I participate in the meetings, if I sort of, you know, am an active participant in Narcotics Anonymous, I won't have to. That's it. Because I'm still terrified of using. You know, I keep telling people I have a time machine inside me. You know, all it will take is to me to get disconnected from the fellowship, one day to be angry and just say, fuck it. I'll walk down, I'll go to the place where they sell drugs, and it'll just take me an hour, pick up, stash, and use, and I'll be back to that desperation and hopelessness of 1995. I'm still terrified of using it. And I've realized that if I want to stay clean, I need to be in the middle of this fellowship. I need to make regular meetings. I need to stay very closely in touch with you all. Because there are times, even today, when I go to office and I head this organization, and there's this whole bunch of people in office. And to me, everyone seems to know what they're doing except me. And I sit there and I open my laptop and I'm consumed with, you know, fear. I still feel that old familiar feeling of being a square peg in a round hole. And then I go to the meeting and I sit down, and it's so comforting to be this misfit in a room full of misfits, not to feel alone. Then it feels, you know what, just hang in there. We all can do it. I can do it also. I'll stay clean another day. So that's where I am. That's what the story of my life. My daughter is now grown up. She's in another country. She studies. Speaking with her. And I'm really glad I've learned how to be a father sitting in these meetings. I've learned how to be a husband sitting in these meetings. No one taught me how to be a father or a husband in these meetings. But I sat amongst you all and I stayed clean. And I've realized if you stay clean long enough, you can figure out all the other skills of life. And I'm not saying I've figured everything out. A lot of life goes by when, you know, when I don't know what's going on, when small things sort of throw me off. You know, last weekend was a bad weekend. There was something in office that had pissed me off. So all of Saturday and Sunday, I had this committee inside my head replaying conversations with, I have two bosses, with both my bosses. What am I going to say? How am I going to resign? How am I going to throw my resignation on their face? But thanks to you all, I didn't. I went to a meeting. I shared my angst. Monday I went, I had an adult conversation with my bosses and the problem got resolved. So that's what I am. An addict, still struggling, trying to live life on its own terms. I remember many years ago, I was about 2 years clean. I had gone to my first convention, and there's this guy who was 22 years clean who had come from the old. And I had looked at him, he looked like he was God walking on earth. And I had, you know, I felt, if I ever reach 22 years clean, I'll have it all wrapped up. I'm 27 years clean. I still haven't got it wrapped up. There's still fear. There's still uncertainty. There's still a lot of, you know, places where I don't know what to do, how to react. But I've realized it's okay. As long as I keep coming back here, as long as I stay with y'all, I'll stay clean. And if I stay clean, I'll be able to figure it out. So that's where I am. I just like to end by saying, you know, I'd really like to thank my mom. You know, there was a lot of mixed stuff. There was a lot of anger that I had with her. But she was the one who pawned her jewelry to put me into that last treatment center. In my family, no one's ever seen the inside of a pawn shop. And she, I guess, swallowed her pride and did that. I need to remember that. I'm really grateful to my wife. She's been a very, very supportive partner. And my daughter. She's honestly the love of my life. So that's what I am. Thanks a ton. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my story with you. Thank you.